Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
George Saunders' 10th of December was named one of the best books of last year by the New York Times Magazine, NPR, Entertainment Weekly, New York, Kirkus Reviews, Book Page, Shelf Awareness, and People Magazine. It was a National Book Award finalist and won the Folio Prize. The collection of short stories highlights Saunders' signature style, and it's now available in paperback. And it's a great pleasure to welcome George Saunders to the Roundtable.
Do you quite understand what it is about your particular brand of writing and about this collection that has struck a chord with readers?
I do not, actually. I have thought about it. I have a feeling it might be like in that Fitzgerald thing where someone said, how did you go broke? And the guy said, gradually and then all at once. Like I could feel the last couple of years getting a little bigger crowds, you know, so I'm not really sure. It seems like just kind of a great, enjoyable thing, but I can't really explain it.
When you start to write something like this, is it always in the guise of, I want to write these stories so they will become a collection? Or is it always the individual story first?
It's even smaller. I mean, usually it's just some nugget, some fragment of a story that I'm working on, trying to get it to kind of reveal itself a little bit. So it'll be, at any given time, you know, maybe I have four pages and I'm not sure where it goes. Maybe it's even two different stories. And so for me, the big challenge is to resist that urge to figure out what it is too early and just kind of mess with it. It's weird because if I do that, the story will sprout some kind of tendril that will start to look like plot, and then it'll allow itself to grow. But if I put the cart before the horse and start deciding things in advance, I usually end up wasting a lot of time. So for me, the challenge is to stay out of it as much as I can, kind of respect the text and just let it accrete on its own.
There is a limit to the growth of that tendril just by the sake that it's a short story, though.
Yeah. My thought is that, you know, the subconscious, I'm not sure I use that word correctly, but whatever it is, it's just below your conceptual mind, is really, really smart, incredibly hyper-organized and insightful. So for me, the trick is to get the conceptual part of it off to the side if I can and just say, you know, whatever I write during the next X years, I'm going to assume that there's a controlling wisdom in the way that those stories appear and get completed. And at the end of some period, when it feels right, I just look at what I have and say, yeah, you don't actually belong in this collection. Sorry, you're out. Maybe I need a little something extra. It's really kind of intuitive, just sort of feeling your way towards something that feels like a complete set and then reordering that to taste. And I'm not a real big high concept writer.
You choose the order.
I obsess over the order. I just usually get some index cards and kind of lay out one for each story with the first and last line, and then just start moving around and try to see, you know, really with the idea of almost like a carnival ride, you know, like you'd want to come in with something that would get some attention, and then for the middle, just build a series of experiences that are, you know, a pleasure burst, then maybe something a little more contemplative, and then maybe something really contemplative, and about the time the reader's going to check out, you do another pleasure burst. And so it's really kind of like, I think maybe like putting an album together. The real goal is you don't want anybody to walk away.
Billy Collins explained that to me, the poet, the exact same way of having the cards and putting them out on the floor and waking up in the middle of the night and kind of changing them around and going back after thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing because I think as someone who teaches writing, we often think about these artistic decisions as if they must be sort of very logical and intellectual. And in my experiences, they're more seat of the pants, maybe like cooking to taste or something where if you learn to trust your on-the-spot intuitions, you can put 1,000 of those in order or, you know, put 1,000 of those together in a book, and they actually mean bigger than you could have meant in advance. The idea is that you're actually kind of in charge of spontaneity and then organizing a bunch of these spontaneous events into a book.
Is there a point where the limit of a short story makes it more magical?
That's a great description of the form, you know, that it's so short and it's the expectations are so high and the risk of failure is high because if you fail in a story, everybody knows it. You know, you can kind of feel that disappointed, you know, the air goes out of the room. So I think like telling a joke or maybe writing a pop song, you're committing to the constraint of time. And that sort of ups the ante, I think, in a really delicious way.
How did you find the form of short story?
I think it was mostly just, that's what I was reading. I was a big Hemingway fan, loved In Our Time. I was aware that I had a very limited talent, and I also wasn't very well read. I'd been an engineering student. So I thought, well, it must be easier if it's shorter, you know, so I'll try 2 pages, try 3 pages. And then I went to the grad program in Syracuse, and at that time in the 80s, and now too, actually, the story is really kind of the easiest thing to teach in a workshop. So we were reading a lot of those. And I just kind of fell in love with Hemingway and de Maupassant and Isaac Babel. You know, sometimes you just find something that thrills you. And when I was in my 20s, the idea of being known as a story writer just seemed so glamorous to me. You know, it seemed cooler than anything. So really, I just kind of got on that. And I think, like a lot of people, I thought, well, I'll train with the short story to go to the real thing, which is a novel. And I never really found that jump to be necessary or natural. The story still is so hard, you know, so fascinating.
Tobias Wolff was
your teacher. Tobias Wolff's my teacher, yeah, yeah.
What do you learn from a mind like that?
Oh, man. Well, the main thing that I learned was to read the stories and see how subtle and layered and powerful and intentional they are, and read them many, many times. And then the added bonus of studying with him was you could walk out and look at him, and you could see how he behaved with his family, and you could see the way he taught. I don't think I'd ever had a feeling of how much you could do with craft, with discipline and hard work. So then to see those beautiful stories, that they were actually connected to a physical human being who wasn't levitating above the earth, you know, but you knew that something he was doing in those 4 or 5 hours of writing was making him a great writer. So that was encouraging to me, because he was a wonderful guy. He wasn't I thought writers had to be wild people and kind of rude, and he was just a exemplary, wonderful human being. But somehow he was getting magic to happen, and you had to conclude it was just work, you know, which I took a lot of consolation in that I didn't have to be a biker or a kind of a ninja, and you just had to go in your room for 4 or 5 hours and do whatever it was he was doing in there.
Do you still, though, in the writing, search for a novel and think, oh, this may be it?
Sometimes, sure. Yeah, I think there's part of everybody that a big 700-page thing would be great. What I try to do is search for whatever's there. And certainly sometimes your mind goes, this is it, man, you did, you know, you finally turned the corner. But the beauty of this approach of coming in every day and kind of starting over is that at some point, if it's not, your mind will tell you. You get to page 40 and you'll find yourself dozing off and you realize that you've misidentified this thing. So for me, the whole thing is to kind of be really grateful if anything happens at all. And that in turn will make you kind of willing to give up the novel if it's not a novel, you know. Or on the other hand, you know, if someday it happens, then you'll be there to receive it. I think the proper sort of stance for me is sort of hopeful and grateful. You know, I'm really happy to be an artist at all. Please, oh story God, will you give me one paragraph today, and don't get too greedy.
You used the word intentional a moment ago in the writing of a story, of it being intentional. And I assume when you write, we'll come out and we can analyze it and say, oh, this is a story about separation and loss and solace.
Right.
But that isn't intentional going in saying, I'm going to write about these.
No, I mean, I've done it, and it just usually doesn't work out, because the danger is that it'll just be that thing. You'll say, I'm going to write a story about solace. And then 4 paragraphs in, the reader is super smart, and she'll say, oh, you're writing a story about solace. So there's something much more exciting about the story form, which is that you don't know what it is, you know, and you're hoping it's going to be something, and you're hoping that when it announces what it is, you won't miss the signal. And so the thrill is the reader is there with you. Neither one of you really knows what this journey is going to wind up to be. So that's pretty high wire stuff, and it's fun. And it's also, there's respect built in. If you and I are on this thing together, I'm writing, you're reading. If I know what it's about, then I'm just kind of backing up the manure truck filled with my meaning and saying, dear reader, stand there a second while I administer this, you know. You know, nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that. But if we're in it together and we're both looking at the story and sensing the subtle energy that comes off it, then it can be a really intimate, thrilling kind of a deal.
I like the meaning equals manure equation.
Yeah.
I must say.
Mine usually does. I don't know.
So what is intentional about it?
For me, it's the iterative quality. In other words, if I go through a story 400 times, by the end of it, it's kind of like I approve this message. You know, I couldn't probably predict all the valences that it will have for you, but basically I've approved every single thing in there down to the comma, and I like it. And so that level of intentionality is iterative, and it's a little bit, again, below the surface. Once you read a story 400 times and have made those countless choices, there's more of you in there than you could have intended to put in there at the beginning.
In writing an individual story, can you have more than one going?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And actually, I've had, maybe recently I had a blank table, but back to 1988, I had stuff going on in an unbroken line. Because I really dread that moment when you have nothing going on. Because at that moment, that's when you're liable to say, well, what am I really writing about? Or what's my purpose? And then, you know, that way madness lies. So I try to have 4 or 5 things going at once. And then really just go in the morning and say, are any of you guys going to be any fun? And hopefully one of them goes, well, I might be a little fun. And then you just pull that one forward and start goofing around with it a little bit.
And then is there a point where you say, okay, I'm going to commit to you?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. A story will sort of be giving you a lot, and you can sort of feel that it's full and then it's ready to be finished. And then you'll put the other ones aside for a while and just try to get that done. And then sometimes you'll hit a wall with that one and set it aside. But for me, the trick is to kind of put fun first. It should be enjoyable. It shouldn't be rocket science. It shouldn't be dreadful. It shouldn't be terrifying. It should be kind of enjoyable for you as a reader and hopefully for the writer.
I want to read a sentence from the first story, Victory Lap. Kissing him last night at the pep rally had been like kissing an underpass. Scary. Kissing Matt was suddenly this cow in a sweater is bearing down on you, who will not take no for an answer, and his huge cow head is being flooded by chemicals that are drowning out what little powers of reason Matt actually did have. When you talk about fun, is it fun to write a sentence like that?
Very fun. Yeah, that whole story was a riot. I do this thing that I think of as third-person ventriloquist, where it's kind of a classic third-person stream of consciousness, except you agree to be constrained by the diction and thought patterns of your character. So in that case, it's a 15-year-old girl. And so it's really fun to be, you know, a 97-year-old dude and sort of go, okay, I'm going to now channel my 15-year-old girl. And you can, you know, it's weird because you can do it. You can actually find the corresponding voice or a corresponding voice. So yeah, nothing but fun.
And what is interesting in that story, isn't so many of the stories, is there's so much going on in that head. There's so much rattling around.
I love that as a source of prose. What could be better than the cacophony of your own brain, you know? And I think it's been fun for me as I've worked with this technique to kind of go, well, all right, let's just see in 10 seconds of sitting here, what actually is going on in the brain? And it's amazing the things that, you know, you'll get bursts of childhood memory and little flurry of paranoia. And, you know, I mean, it's endless what can go on in the human mind.
So in reading this, I was wondering if that makes you a keen observer or a keen observer of language and of words? And is there a difference?
I think that's a great question. I think there's not a difference, actually. You are a keen observer. You're a keen observer of language. You're a keen generator of language. And all of that amounts to a kind of awareness of something. I don't know exactly what. And in some ways, it shouldn't, you know, it's funny, fiction shouldn't really make sense. You've got me channeling a 15-year-old girl, which I'm inventing. I'm channeling my own 15-year-old girl. And then I'm making things happen to her. Why in the world would that be of interest? But somehow there's something magical in that observational state that I think it makes a bridge between you and another person. And why, I don't know. But having been the recipient of it, you just sort of trust it, I guess.
Having read your previous collections, it seems as though, and I guess this would be natural, that there is a maturity and a level of, I've read in many of the reviews the term dark, that would be a dark turn, right? or even begin in a dark place and then move. But there seems to be a great deal of heart in these stories that perhaps was not as large in previous stories.
Yeah. I think you're just right. And that darkness thing, I kind of struggle with it because I don't feel at all that life is a dark proposition. But a story is not a mirror. You know, a story is a game. And so it's a game that starts with a what if proposition. What if a guy turned into a bug? The what if doesn't tell you much about the writer's life view. But what happens after that does. So in Kafka, the fact that he posits that Gregor turns into a bug may or may not mean anything to Kafka. But then in the next beat, you know, Gregor wakes up, he sees he's a bug. He doesn't say, oh my God, I'm a bug. He says, oh my God, I'll be late for work. And suddenly then you've got a story that's about something. So for me, the darkness is just kind of an offset that maybe because I'm not very subtle, you know, for me, I want something to happen dramatically, so I make it dangerous or I make it the worst day of a character's life or, you know, there's a potential for the baby to go off the cliff. That doesn't, to me, say anything about worldview. But then what happens afterwards? How does the person respond in that moment of great peril or darkness or whatever? That's where I feel more of myself coming in. And as you said very correctly, as I'm getting older, I find myself more interested in the response that's not catastrophic. When something arises in a person that allows them to transcend a situation, that's kind of more interesting to me, maybe. And I don't think I really know why. I think it's partly just maturing, but it's also artistically, you know, it's almost like you're exploring a house. The house is your talent, and you work through the lower rooms first. And as you get older, you're like, well, I've already been down to the second floor. I got to come up. Mm-hmm. And for me, the coming up somehow involves trying to avoid sentimentality or kind of false uplift, trying to really say, all right, what is it like here on Earth? Is it really the case that everything sucks and we're all full of dread and we're mean whenever we can be? I haven't experienced that. On the other hand, is it the case that everybody is a perfectly polite, wonderful human being who always does the right thing? No. So the truth is somewhere in the middle there, and I think I'm just trying to find the correct mix of those two things, maybe.
George Saunders' book is 10th of December. It is published by Random House. George Saunders, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much and wish you all the luck in the world.
Pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
George Saunders' 10th of December is available in paperback. It is published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.